I wonder if you've ever noticed that there is in most of us a kind of negative bit that tends to look on the darker side of things. You know how it is, someone comes up to you and says something nice about you, the hat you're wearing or your suit or those nice Tony shoes that you've just bought yourself. Or they say something nice about the weather or about someone else or something complimentary about some situation or another. And you react by deprecating the whole business and by seeing the greys and the darker side in a pessimistic sort of way. Well, it is a nice hat, you know, but it didn't cost me much. I just got it in Littlewoods. Or, well, I suppose the shoes are Tony enough, but you know, they were quite cheap. I got them at a sale. You see, you deprecate the niceness. And perhaps you're the sort of person who says when somebody comes up to you on a marvelous summer's day and the skies are blue and says to you, well, that's a real corker of a day for you, and you look up to the sky and say, well, I don't suppose it can last. You see, there is a negative bit in us which tends to deprecate the nice. And you see that negative, pessimistic bit in Zion here in verse 14. And Zion says, the Lord has forsaken me. My Lord has forgotten me. But in fact, the background to that complaint from Zion and that deprecation is a very wonderful and a very grand background, because God has just been speaking to Zion about the deeds that he is going to do on a grand scale for Zion, because Zion has been in bondage for 70 years in Babylon, and the time has come for God's people to be redeemed and to be rescued from Babylon and brought home again. And in verses 9, 10, and 11 of Isaiah 49, God makes the most astonishing promises to his people in bondage. He says to the prisoners in verse 9 that they're going to come out of the dark prison house of Babylonian bondage. And in the second half of verse 9, he even promises that the barren mountaintops on the journey home to Jerusalem, mountaintops which are normally very rocky and desolate places, will be pasture land for God's people. They shall feed along the highways, and on all the barren heights shall be their pasture. In verse 10, God promises that even if the journey home to Jerusalem takes them through deserts, in the desert there will be plenty of water and springs for God's refugees. They shall not hunger or thirst, neither scorching wind nor sun shall smite them. And by springs of water in the desert will he guide them. And in verse 7, you get this astonishing promise that when God brings home his people to Zion, he is going to bulldoze all the mountains out of their way. I will make all my mountains a way, a road of access. All of these mighty works of God, all of these promises of what God is going to do to his church. And yet Zion responds with this complaint and this rather dark bit, this rather self-pitying bit, this pessimism. Zion said, "The Lord has forsaken me. My Lord has forgotten me." It's a sentiment that is very wonderfully summed up in another phrase used by Isaiah's compatriot Jeremiah in his Book of Lamentations. Now, the Book of Lamentations is called the Book of Lamentations because it is a lamentation for the downfall of Zion. And in Lamentations chapter 1 and verse 4, Jeremiah sets the note and strikes the note and sets the whole ethos for what he's going to say in Lamentations. "The ways of Zion do mourn." And here you see a church in mourning. A church that is stricken and is feeling forsaken by God. Have you ever gone through that? Have you ever felt in your soul that God had really abandoned you? Have you suspected in one of your worst moments that God just wasn't interested in you any more and that he really had no care for you any more? "The ways of Zion do mourn. The Lord has forsaken me. My Lord has forgotten me." God makes marvelous promises to Zion, and Zion deprecates the promises. It's George Adam Smith and one or two other of the commentators who point out that the best way to understand this second half of Isaiah 49, from about verse 13 onwards, the passage we read, is to see behind this text here three of these protests coming from the Church of God. You may know that the second half of the book of Isaiah is bursting with all sorts of marvelous promises from God. A promise of redemption, a promise of hope, promises of forgiveness, promises of comfort, promises of restoration. The church is going to be restored. A new day will dawn for God's cause. "The ransomed of the Lord," says Isaiah later on, "the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sighing and sorrow shall flee away." The second half of Isaiah is just bursting with promises such as these. And Zion deprecates the promises of God and protests against the promises. God says, "I'm going to bring you to a spiritual awakening. I'm going to take you out of your prison and bring you back to the land, to Jerusalem. I'm going to revive you." And Zion sees the dark side. Now, in fact, there are three protests from Zion here. The first is the one we've been thinking about in verse 14. Zion feels that God has abandoned her altogether. God just is no longer interested. God no longer cares. "The Lord has forsaken me. My Lord has forgotten me." The second protest is from verse 19 onwards. And Zion says that, "How can all your promises come true? The land is a waste place, and its inhabitants few." How can your promises come true? And the third protest is from the 24th verse. Can prisoners really be liberated? You find the question there in verse 24. Can the prey be taken from the mighty? Is it possible? Can the captives of a tyrant be rescued? Is it possible? There are the three protests. God has abandoned us. The place is a desolation, and there's hardly anybody left. Is it possible for prisoners to escape? And these three protests from Zion are answered and indeed silenced by God. And the answer to the first protest is a vision of God's evangelical heart and his evangelical hands. The answer to the second protest is a vision of evangelical hope. And the answer to the third protest is an answer of evangelical help. A heart and hands, a hope, and a help. And these are God's answers to the yearnings of Zion. Now, the first protest is found in verse 14, where Zion thinks that God has abandoned his church completely and forgotten his work. And there's a great sight here. It is a sight of the heart of God seen in its femininity. There is a motherliness in the heart of God. Can a woman forget her sucking child, that she should have no compassion on the son of her womb? Even these earthly mothers may forget, yet I will not forget you. There is a motherliness in the heart of God. I wonder if you're familiar with these words from Isaiah 66, which I read at a very distressing funeral in Fraserburgh on Wednesday, where there was a great deal of heart searching and heartbreak and distress. These words from Isaiah 66 and verse 13. As one whom his mother comforts, so I will comfort you. Words used by Brahms in that lovely soprano solo with the lovely chorale behind it in his German Requiem. As one whom his mother comforts, so I will comfort you, and you shall be comforted in Jerusalem. You shall see, and your heart shall rejoice, and your bones shall flourish like the grass, and it shall be known that the hand of the Lord is with his servants. Let me just correct that then. There isn't simply a motherliness in the heart of God. There is a super motherliness in the evangelical heart of God. Because the love of God and the care of God and the compassion of God transcend mother love. You see, a mother can forget. She can be careless and forget the little child in all his need and his hunger. And even for a moment, she can let the child slip out of mind because of her preoccupation with other things in the home. And we all know that sometimes accidents can happen because the mother, for an instant, forgot the child. But the love of God is a love that transcends maternal love, and that transcendent love sees to it that you are never forgotten by the evangelical heart of God. I wonder if this is where some of these erroneous views on the motherhood of God came from. You know, I think I have a great deal of sympathy with some of the views that have been expressed in the motherhood of God question. I'm sure that some of the views have been expressed rather carelessly and have just lacked accuracy. And there's no doubt that when the ladies in Edinburgh and the General Assembly were preoccupied with the theme of the motherhood of God, a good deal of the imagery that they used was anything but biblical. And I think not a little of their imagery came not from the Bible, but from various liberation sources, not just mannish women, but effeminate men, all part of the unisex movement of our generation, for which you certainly don't find any substance whatsoever in scripture. There's nothing to support that sort of thing. Male and female created he them. That's the creation ordinance. That's Genesis chapters 1 and 2. God built it into the universe. Male and female created he them. Not male and male created he them. Or female and female created he them. That's what the liberation crowds are saying. There's none of that in the Bible. God is called he and him in the Bible. And Jesus is called the Son. You can't have a female he. Oh, some would want us to have that. And you can't have a feminine masculine. Or a masculine feminine. But it took my good friend, Dr. Mary Philip in Holyrood Abbey Manse in Edinburgh, with whom I was discussing these things, it took Mary Philip to remind me that as a spirit, God transcends sexuality. And it's because he transcends both fatherhood and motherhood as we understand them. That is why God's understanding of men and women is so total. God understands us, whatever our sex. God understands us through and through. And his understanding of us is trenchant and perspicuous. He sees through you without despising you. In this world, sometimes when people say they see through you, secretly they despise you. But God doesn't do that. He sees through you. His understanding of you is total. And he loves you because his tenderness and his gentleness and his care for you transcend both paternality and maternality. His love is a super fatherly love as well as a super motherly love. That's why he never forgets you in his evangelical heart of love. The second vision here, in answer to the first protest, is a vision of God's evangelical hands in verse 16. And these hands are visible tokens of his evangelical heart. They are the outward expression of his heart. And he says to you when you are down and out and discouraged and you think that he's abandoned you and forgotten you and doesn't care for you, he holds out his hands to you and he says, "Now, this is what my heart is like. I have graven you on the palms of my hands, and your walls are continually before me." Now, there are all sorts of suggestions as to what this means. It means God having you carved on the palms of his hands. Some of them, all the writers suggest that this is rather like Mizpah. Remember how fashionable it was for sweethearts to give each other little Mizpah signs. Okay, so I'm over 50. All right. Mizpah, which means the Lord watch between me and thee while we are apart. Remember that? Mizpah is a great thing. Or nowadays, what they give is, the thing round the neck. It's a sign or a token. It's usually a disc with little meaningless marks on the disc. And then you whirl the disc, and it spells out, "I love you." Have you seen those? No. I'm too observant, yes. Or sometimes it's the person's name. You spin the disc. It's a little disc. And it turns round, you see, because it's on a pivot. And at first sight, all you just see are little marks cut in the gold. But if you spin it, it says, "I love you," or "Mizpah," or it's the person's name. Some suggest that we are graven on God's hands like a kind of tattoo needled into the skin. So that whenever God looks at his hands, he sees you, and he sees the walls of the West Church. And there they are, tattooed into the skin of his hands, in much the same way in which soldiers and sailors in Victorian days, it was a great fashion, because of course soldiers were away from home, and sailors were away from home much longer than they are nowadays in Victoria's day. When you said cheerio to your soldier or your sailor sweetheart, you said cheerio for a long time, because he was away to serve the Queen at the other end of the empire. And so they used to tattoo the sweetheart's name on their hands, so that they would be reminded in China or India of the sweetheart. You know the story of the man who had "I love Jessie" tattooed in his arm, and then he married a girl called Margaret, and he spent the rest of his marriage living that down, because you can't remove it, you see. So I suppose choose your sweetheart wisely before you get tattooed. And some have even suggested that what God has on his hands is a blueprint of the church, like an architect having a model. And the model is there always in front of him to remind him of the building. And some even suggest that what God is looking at is a signet ring with your name on it. Well, I suppose there's a great deal of truth in all of these. But the heart of the message is unaltered. The hands of God are evangelical hands. and they are an expression of his evangelical heart. You may feel abandoned and down and out and hopeless. You can feel yourself to be a washout. Even a washout as a Christian. You can think that you're forgotten and abandoned and uncared for by God. But as George Adam Smith points out in his commentary, reality, like this, reality is not what you see, or even what you feel. Reality is what God sees and what God feels about you. I will never forget you. My heart is an evangelical heart. My love for you is a super maternal love. It transcends mother love. Now God says, look at my hands. There you are. I have graven you on the palms of my hands. Your walls are continually before me. The second complaint from Zion starts at verse 19, and the complaint and protest is that in spite of all God's promises, in the first half of the chapter, the land lies desolate and the inhabitants are few. And God's answer to that is a word of evangelical hope in verse 19. As you look around the church today, have you the faith to claim verses 19 and 20? Surely your waste and your desolate places and your devastated land, surely now you will be too narrow for your inhabitants. And those who swallowed you up will be far away. The children born in the time of your bereavement will yet say in your ears, the place is too narrow for me. Make room for me to dwell in. Now, if you know anything about Old Testament imagery, you'll know that the imagery here is that of widowhood. Because in the Old Testament, it was traditional to think of a widow as someone who had been desolate and forsaken and who had cast off. And desolate and forsaken are the customary standard adjectives used to describe a woman who has lost her husband. And the picture is of a church that has lost her husband. She has been widowed, and she is under judgment and desolate. She is a church in mourning. And I do not think that any thinking Christian can question that that is a very accurate portrayal of the state of the church in our own generation. Read Life and Work this month. I know that some of it is pretty dreich. Yes, I can see you smiling. It is indeed pretty dreich. But there are one or two interesting articles in it, and I find it curious that men who once would have dissociated themselves from a conservative evangelical position, men at the top, as we sometimes call them, a churchman, are now talking in public about the utter ignorance of the church and ignorance of even the most basic things of the gospel. Read Life and Work. Ignorance of Jesus Christ himself. And these men are now speaking about the need for an evangelical revival. Well, there's a nice vault fast for you. There's a nice turning round of positions. And the pessimism of the men at the top, and you should have seen the men in the General Assembly this year wringing their hands about the death in the churches. That pessimism can spring from only one reality, and it is that the churches are now living under the displeasure of God. God is not pleased with the churches. Of course, here and there you do get blessing. And here and there you do get growth. And here and there you do get signs of life, and you thank God for the new signs of life in Scotland today. But generally speaking, the picture is of death and more death and disinterest and prayerlessness and unbelief and deadness and woodenness. A church into widowhood and mourning. What do you think all these empty pews mean? I know some people are old, frail. I know some are bored. I know one or two. And it's the deepest wish of their hearts that I should go far away. Mongolia or Siberia, the nearest salt mine. I'll go to Mongolia when God tells me to go to Mongolia. You think these empty pews mean? See, the church is a widow. She's in mourning. I had a visit this week from Fergus Robertson's father, a very brilliant chap, fine thinking man. And he phoned me up and he said, well, not that I could afford the time, but I said yes. He said, I'm writing an article on the present hopes for the work of Christ in Scotland, and it has some theological undertones, and I want to come and see you. So he came over and we had a cup of coffee, and eventually we came round to prayer, and he was the man who started speaking about prayer, not I. I wasn't pushing it. And he said he'd come to pick my brains about prayer, as if I was the last authority in prayer, which I certainly ain't. He spoke of all the world's problems, a whole list of them, Ulster and Lebanon, with the possibility of a new war there, and the bomb, and the feeling in the West that we should get rid of all these nuclear things, and Russia and Afghanistan, and all the international chaos and the violence of our generation. And Mr. Robertson said, do you think prayer could change any of that? And I said, well, sir, I'll ask you a more basic problem. Do you think the churches today believe that prayer changes anything? And he was forced to admit that the evidence was from the churches today that people do not believe that prayer changes anything, that prayer moves the hand of God, and that God can work in international situations. See, the whole evidence today is that people don't believe in prayer. If they did, they would pray. It's as simple as that. I'm sorry to be so unhelpful and so naive. But if people believed in prayer, they would pray, and they don't pray. For a whole variety of reasons. So the picture is of a widow who's in mourning. And into that mourning comes God's answer of a word of evangelical hope. And it still stands. God says, all right, your land is desolate. That's true. Look round Scotland. The inhabitants are few. Look round Scotland. God said, the day is coming when the land will be too narrow for your inhabitants, and children born to you in your widowhood will say, come on, this place is too narrow for me. Make room for me to dwell in. I want to read you a bit of a sermon preached by Martin Allen of Christham Church down in the outskirts of Glasgow at one of our Creef conferences. A very, very, very fine sermon. He was speaking about the deadness of the church in the early 1700s. And he says in that sermon, in 1736, Bishop Butler wrote his Analogy of Religion. We had to read it in our moral philosophy classes. Of course, I was an unbeliever then and didn't understand it, but we still had to read it and answer questions on Butler's Analogy, as it was called. Bishop Butler was at that time the foremost philosopher in Britain, and he doubted whether anyone was going to succeed him as bishop, because it seemed improbable to him that Christianity would survive even his own lifetime. Bishop Butler really thought that Christianity was going to die in the early 1700s. It was an age of decadence, unbelief, and gross irreligion. Now, we think the churches are empty today. You should have lived in the early 1700s. If a parish minister saw 10 people at morning worship, he was delighted. And there was no evening service at all. Evening services are an innovation. Evening services are a modernistic thing. They only started last century. All that there was the morning service. Morning worship. Parish worship. Nothing else. And nobody came. In the Church of England, if the vicar saw half a dozen people at morning communion for morning song, he was pleased. It was an age of decadence, unbelief, and gross irreligion. And Bishop Butler wrote in his preface to his book, The Analogy of Religion, quote, "It has come to be taken for granted that Christianity is not so much a matter for inquiry, but is now at length discovered to be fictitious." 2 years later, in 1736, there was a man sitting in the back seat in Aldersgate Street in London at a little meeting, listening to somebody reading Martin Luther's preface to the Epistle to the Romans. That man's heart was strangely warmed. His name was John Wesley, and a year later he did an unprecedented thing for an Anglican! He stepped out from Bristol and stood on a mound of earth, and he preached to the coal miners of Kingswood. and a flame was ignited and spread like wildfire, so that by the end of Bishop Butler's life, far from Christianity being extinguished, it had literally changed the face of society in Britain. The Wesleyan Revival. Martin Allen went on in his sermon. I take another example from the following century, from Scotland, and the revival, the awakening around 1839 and 1840. This concerns William C. Burns, the famous William Burns of Kilsyth, who figured so prominently in these days of awakening. There's something interesting about William Burns, according to a letter which he wrote to Murray McCheyne. Burns wrote to McCheyne and said that in his first 7 years of being a Christian preacher, he did not know of one single solitary instance of a person being converted to Christ by his ministry. That's to say, he preached for 7 years, and no one was saved. Well, people are a bit slow to get saved under my preaching. High time some of you were getting converted to Christ. How much longer are you going to hold on? How much longer are you going to keep your life to yourself? When do you want to be saved? A minute before you die? How do you know when you're going to die? Burns said he couldn't point to one individual who seemed to be awakened in any kind of way to seek after God. 7 years of preaching and not a single solitary soul. But all that was changed on Tuesday the 23rd of July, 1839. Burns writes in his diary concerning this morning, which he says was fixed from all eternity as an era in the history of redemption. He was quite an extravagant chap. Burns stepped out of his house in Kilsyth. He had arranged to have an open-air meeting, and much to his disappointment, it was pouring rain. It's obviously happened in Scotland. It was pouring rain, and the cobbled streets were empty. And he walked up Kilsyth. He was told that everybody had gathered at the church. When he went into Kilsyth Church, there was a vast multitude, so much so that he had to fight his way to get in. Looking forward to that. He had to fight his way to get in. When he got up to the pulpit, he saw a mass of people there who'd never been in church in their lives. There were folks from the surrounding districts with, quote, the lowest of the low, quote, as we say, right up to the highest of the high. They were all there, and Burns preached to them from the text, Psalm 110 and verse 3. There shall be a willing people in the day of his power. And when he reached his great climax, it's a famous sermon, this was the climax of it, no cross, no crown. The fire of the Spirit of God came down, and revival spread from that place to Leith, and then to Edinburgh, and then to St. Peter's and Dundee. 7 years without a convert, and then the power. Of course, there were lots of criticisms from church people who were embarrassed by the revival, and they said that his revival was the fruit of a distempered brain, and that the whole thing was just a distraction. And this is what Burns says: if such things are enthusiasm or the fruits of a distempered brain, let my brain be evermore possessed of that holy distemper. If this be distraction, I pray God that the world of mankind may be seized with this benign, meek, beneficent, beautiful, glorious distraction. God's word for a church in widowhood is a word of evangelical hope. And lastly, there is the third protest from Zion. It's 1:45. Can I go on and finish it? May I go on? From verse 24, this is longer than usual tonight. Verse 24, the third protest is, all of this is very charming, but is it possible? Can the prey be taken from the mighty, or the captives of a tyrant be rescued? And God's answer to that is a word of evangelical help. You find it at the end of verse 25. I will contend with those who contend with you, and I will save your children. You see, it is one of the lies of the devil in our generation that there is no hope and no help. And Satan convinces men and women in our despairing society that they are trapped forever, that they are prisoners forever, that they are victims forever of their own passions and of drink and of sensuality, that they are the victims of chance and of fate and circumstance. They are trapped and they're doomed and there's no way out. There is no escape. And it's that that has led to the most awful situations in our society. Suicide. Because there's no escape. And addictions of all sorts, and alcoholism, and people frantically trying to get away from reality, and from their hopelessness, and from the truth. God says, surely, even the captives of the mighty shall be taken, and the prey of the tyrant shall be rescued.